So it's November 7th, 2020, and this is from 26 Second Avenue over the internet. We're reading from Bhagavad Gita, Chapter 2, Contents of the Gita Summarized, Text 15. Yam hi na vata yantyete purusham purusharshava samadukha sukham dhiram somritat vayakalpate. Yam, one to whom, he, certainly, na, never, vyatayanti, are distressing, ete, all these, purusham, to a person, purusha rishabha, O best among men, sama, unaltered, dukkha, in distress, sukham, and happiness, dhiram, patient, saha, he, amritatvaya, for liberation, kalpate, is considered eligible. Srila Prabhupada's translation. O best among men, Arjuna, the person who is not disturbed by happiness and distress, and is steady in both, is certainly eligible for liberation. Srila Prabhupada's purport. Anyone who is steady in his determination for the advanced stage of spiritual realization and can equally tolerate the onslaughts of distress and happiness is certainly a person eligible for liberation. In the Varnashrama institution, the fourth stage of life, namely the renounced order, sannyasa, is a painstaking situation. But one who is serious about making his life perfect surely adopts the sannyas order of life in spite of all difficulties. The difficulties usually arise from having to sever family relationships, to give up the connection of wife and children. But if anyone is able to tolerate such difficulties, surely his path to spiritual realization is complete. Similarly, in Arjuna's discharge of duties as a kshatriya, he is advised to persevere, even if it is difficult to fight with his family members or similarly beloved persons. Lord Chaitanya took sannyasa at the age of 24, and his dependents, young wife as well as old mother, had no one else to look after them. Yet, for a higher cause, he took sannyasa and was steady in the discharge of higher duties. That is the way of achieving liberation from material bondage. Yam hi vya vata yantye te purusham purushar shabha samadukha sukham dhiram somritat vaya kalpate. O best among men, Arjuna, the person who is not disturbed by happiness and distress and is steady in both is certainly eligible for liberation. It's interesting, this word sama, which means the same. One stays the same. Dhira, which in the word for word here is patient or sober, steady. One is steady in both, becomes eligible for liberation. Such a person is able to be liberated. So it seems that to be steady or unchanged in happiness and distress would not be a particularly desirable state. Because all of us are what's called in Sanskrit anandamaya vyasat. We are all pleasure-seeking beings. Srila Prabhupada was once asked, what is the purpose of life? And he said, the purpose is ananda. The purpose is happiness. And the scientists speak about this as the pleasure principle, that all of us go towards pleasure and away from pain. In fact, such is practically a biological imperative, that we stay away from things which will cause us injury or disease or to be ostracized from our group, and we go towards things that will bring us nourishment and satisfaction, and such is the principle for all life. So it seems that if we were to remain sama or dhira in both happiness and distress, that we would die. Or we would become injured, or, you know, we wouldn't get enough food, or something like that. That we would, and also it seems that, practically speaking, we wouldn't be alive. You know, A machine doesn't go towards happiness or away from distress. A machine is neutral in both. The machines around me, my computer, my recorder, my phone, the lights, they don't care if they're happy or distressed. In fact, they have no sense of happiness or distress. It doesn't mean anything to them. My computer does its job whether things are nice or things are not nice. You know, it's unaffected by such things. It has no, again, it doesn't even mean anything to a machine, happiness and distress. What does that mean? Favorable and unfavorable. So why would we want to do that? And why does that make us eligible for liberation? And how would we do that? Well, let's look at happiness and the kind of happiness and distress that Krishna is speaking about here. He is talking about happiness and distress in regard to the senses and the mind. In fact, Krishna makes very clear in the Bhagavad Gita that all material happiness and distress is a function of the mind. Such a point is also made very clearly in the Bhagavatam 11th canto. There's this one person who goes through all the difficulty in life. And he says, the difficulty is not coming from anything other than my own mind. That our mind, and there's a lot of agreement on this point from medical science. Medical science will show that there's not really a part of the brain that, for example, says, I'm in pain. It's not like there's some objective meaning to pain or pleasure. But that's an opinion. Pain and pleasure is an opinion of the brain, is the way they would put it. You know, the brain decides this. And we know that because we know that we can be in a similar situation at two different times, and at one time we can consider that situation pleasurable, and another time we can consider that exact same situation painful. Now, Srila Prabhupada would give the example of water, of having a bath. So, and when it's very hot out, we would consider a bath to be pleasurable, and when it's very cold out, we might consider that same bath to be painful. And I remember being in India once during the hot season. It was right after the hot season. And it was extremely hot and humid. I was in Mayapur Dham. It was so hot and so humid that I literally had to take 5 very cold showers a day just so that I could think. So going a few hours, you know, without cooling down in some way. My brain didn't work much. I felt like my brain was overheating. And I would go under this very cold water and pour it on my head. But I certainly wouldn't want to do that in the circumstance I'm in now. And I wouldn't want to do that in India in the winter. That would be a very painful situation. So what we decide as pleasure or pain depends upon our interpretation, depends upon our circumstance. You know, in some circumstance, talking with a good friend is pleasurable, and in another circumstance, talking to that same person is painful, even talking about the same thing. Right? It depends what else is going on in our life, how we're interpreting it, and so forth. And a person engaged in sports, and their muscles are hurting, and they're sweating, but they're interpreting that as painful, as pleasurable, because they're in a sport. Whereas, you know, otherwise it may interpret it as painful. So it really is a question of interpretation of the brain. It's also quite interesting, just like sometimes soldiers get severely wounded, like their arm gets blown off, but they don't experience any pain from that injury because they're in the middle of fighting. And so they're just focused on the fighting, and their brain does not interpret the lack of an arm as a painful situation until later, after they're no longer in danger, and they're, oh my goodness, my arm's gone, and then they experience pain. One of the most interesting studies that I looked at was this man who was working at a construction site, and all of a sudden he looks down at his foot, and there's a nail going through his shoe, and he just starts screaming in pain, goes to the hospital, and then they remove the shoe. They see that the nail had gone between the toes and not caused any injury at all. But visually, looking at it, he thought that he must have, you know, gone through his foot, so he was screaming in pain. Another very interesting story is this one researcher who was going through what they call the bush in Australia, what we would call in America a forest. And as he was going through, he felt something touch his left leg, and he thought, oh, it's a twig, touch my left leg. And a little while later, he collapses and almost dies. And turns out he was bitten by a poisonous snake, and you know, had to be rushed to the hospital and so forth and so on. And then sometime later, he's back again in the forest, and again something touches his left leg. And this time he's screaming in agony and lying on the ground and yelling, and it was just a stick. So, you know, the first time the brain interpreted, I've been hit by a stick, and it was a snake, and so the brain didn't register any pain. And the second time, the brain thought, oh, it's a snake again, when it was just a stick. And so he was screaming in pain. And of course, we have this analogy given in the Shastra about the rope and the snake, that the person who thinks a rope is a snake or a snake is a rope and reacts accordingly. So our ideas of pleasure and pain are within the mind. They're an interpretation of the mind, as it says elsewhere in the Gita. They arise from mental concoction. So this concept of pleasure and pain, one should become detached to, because neither one is real. Now, we should have enough discrimination to avoid getting bitten by snakes and to make sure we eat good food, but to interpret these as pleasurable or painful events and to go toward the pleasurable in terms of thinking, this is going to be my source of happiness, and to go away from the painful thinking, this is going to harm me existentially, means to be in a state of illusion. To one who's transcendentally situated or here eligible for transcendence, one sees that all of these are just simply interpretations of the mind, that none of them have any absolute meaning. And what happens when we run our life by trying to go towards sensory and mental pleasure and away from sensory and mental pain, when that becomes the focus of our life, and when we rejoice in sensory and mental happiness, and we lament and always try to counteract sensory and mental pain, we become tied to this whole illusion of this world and this whole illusion of being the body and the mind. And therefore, it's practically speaking impossible to get liberated from this false idea. So just logically, the more that we're wedded to this false idea, the more impossible it is for us to get free of it. If you think about somebody who's very attached to any sort of illusion, whether it's, you know, a chemical illusion somebody's very attached to, you know, alcohol or drugs, or maybe an electronic illusion somebody's very attached to, you know, playing electronic games, or whatever, you know, if someone's very attached to some illusory situation, it's very, very hard for them to be free from that. How are they going to let go of it? So the way that one becomes free, part of the way that one becomes free, is a sense of equanimity. Again, it doesn't mean that we don't eat healthy food or that we don't avoid poisonous snakes, but it means that one has a sense of equanimity. One is not enjoying the good food or hating the poisonous snake. So what's going to happen to our innate sense of pleasure seeking and pain avoiding, which is really part of our spiritual nature? It's part of our existence as a living being. It's a lot of what makes us alive. How are we going to do that? So we're going to do that on the spiritual level. We're going to substitute pleasure seeking and pain avoidance on the spiritual level for pleasure seeking and pain avoidance on the material level. So what that means, what is spiritual pleasure? Spiritual pleasure is our realization of the presence of Krishna around us, within our heart. Realization of my own self, my own being in the heart. And staying away from this duality of pain and pleasure materially, which is what causes spiritual pain. I mean, it's not really that difficult of a concept. The thing that's causing me spiritual distress is being attached to the illusion, and the thing that's going to cause me spiritual happiness is to be attached to the reality, to see things as they are. So the same tendency is going to be there, just like we have in the six symptoms of surrender. So the six symptoms of surrender, which are accepted by all Vaishnava followers, not only Gaudiya Vaishnava, but Sri Vaishnava, Nimbarka Sampradaya, etc., all branches of these different Sampradayas, so all the followers of the Vedas, accept that there are six principles of surrender. And the first two are always listed as accepting what's favorable for spiritual life and rejecting what's unfavorable for spiritual life. So again, it's not that this tendency towards going towards sukha and away from dukkha, towards happiness and away from distress, is stopped. It's just that we identify what is real happiness and what is real distress. So real happiness is in the question of service to Krishna. Again, for it's seeing who I am. I'm not the body. I'm not the mind. I am a soul. And my real nourishment, my real happiness, is to be aware of my spiritual nature, to be aware of the existence of the whole of which I am a part, to be aware of Krishna in the sunshine, in the moonshine, in the stars, in the air, in the water, in my digestive process, my life breath, my ability, my intelligence, that within other living beings, to be aware of him in his original form, in Vrindavan, playing with the cowherd boys, dancing with the gopis, to have that awareness of him, and to have the proper relationship with him, of service, of working for his happiness. I mean, this is... It may seem a little peculiar that that's my real sense of happiness, is to work for his happiness. But because I am a part of him, mamai vamso jiva loke jiva bhuta sanatana, because I am a part of him, when I work for his happiness, I naturally work for my own happiness. He is called the param atma, the supreme self, the self of the self. So if I'm going to work for my own happiness, and he's the self of myself, then that is ultimately, as Srila Prabhupada would often say, my real self-interest. And Prabhupada would give the example all the time that my hands put food in the mouth. I don't take food and just rub them on my hands. Right? Because my hands know that if it feeds the mouth, that nourishment will then go into my hands. It will benefit my hands. Anything that the parts of my body do for the whole body benefits each part of the body. So I accept everything. I'm running towards everything that is helping me in my spiritual realization. And I go away from anything that harms my spiritual realization. I redefine what is happiness and distress. And anything that's spiritually happy, it's not conditional. And it's not simply an opinion of a brain in a body or a subtle mind. It's actual happiness. It's objective happiness. And it's happiness that's not conditional. So when I feel that happiness of that connection with Krishna through service, I'm going to feel that happiness when it's hot out. I'm going to feel that happiness when it's cold out. I'm going to feel that happiness if people are praising me. I'm going to feel that happiness if people are criticizing me. I'm going to feel that happiness if it's a twig, and I'm going to feel that happiness if it's a snake. It's not dependent on these things. It has no relationship to those things. It exists in all circumstances, in all times, and in all places, which is the kind of happiness that I'm looking for. I don't have to arrange, you know, for material happiness, I have to arrange my life in a certain way so that my senses and mind are satisfied. So that's not really true spiritually. Spiritually, I can connect with Krishna anywhere and at any time, in any circumstances. I can connect with him like devotees were imprisoned in, you know, Siberian labor camps for selling Srila Prabhupada's books. And I can connect with him when I'm, you know, in Vrindavan sitting at Govardhan Hill. So in all of these circumstances. And then when I'm moving away from, is anything that has me lose consciousness of Krishna, that has me lose that sense of connection, that puts me in this illusion that I'm somehow separate, that I'm a material being. And what is that consciousness, the sense of happiness and distress on the material level? So I hope this makes sense to everybody. The sense of happiness and distress on the material level is all, even the happiness part, is all a situation of spiritual distress. All of it. I mean, if I'm relishing happiness of this body, that means I have to identify with the body. And if I'm hating suffering of the body, I'm identifying with the body. If I'm relishing happiness of the mind, I'm identifying with the mind. And if I'm hating happiness of the mind, I'm identifying with the mind. So any identification with something false and illusory is going to take me away from having happiness of the spiritual. So therefore, Krishna is saying, be equipoised to these. Be equipoised to these. So how does one do that? How does one do that? This is a very big and difficult topic. It's not at all easy. Again, we're pleasure-seeking by nature and we're pain-avoidance by nature. On a biological level, we have to be in order to survive. And on an ultimate spiritual level, we are joyful beings like Krishna. We always want to be playing. We always want to be enjoying. And so to just have a neutral attitude towards happiness and distress materially seems to be almost impossible. Now, many people will try to do this by becoming stoic. I just won't care about happiness and distress. Now, as soon as one does that, one is trying to become like a machine or like a rock. Right? I mean, when I was growing up, there was this song by Simon and Garfunkel, you know, I got hurt in love and now I'm a rock in an island and I don't feel any pain. You know, I don't feel any love and I don't feel any pain. But why do we want to be a rock? You know, is that attractive? Be a rock. You won't suffer anymore and you won't enjoy anymore. You'll just be a nothing. All right, well, that might be really attractive if we're in tremendous pain. You know, if we're experiencing some sort of tremendous pain, we might want to go into a state of unconsciousness. You know, we might want to go to the hospital and say, you know, give me anesthesia like you would give somebody in surgery so that I just don't feel anything. Yeah? If ever we're in that much pain, that may be attractive. But that's not a long-term policy. You know, we don't, if someone, you know, you said, okay, well, I'm in terrible pain right now, so give me anesthesia so I don't feel anything. Okay, but if we stay in that point, then we're in a coma. We're a vegetative state. And who wants to be that way? You know, if someone said, I'll take care of all your suffering by putting you in a vegetative state for the next 20 years, we'd be, no thank you. So it's very difficult. So what are the different processes for getting detached? All right, that's not one of them. That's not one of them. To just try to repress everything, to become stone-like, to become unconscious. And many times spiritual practitioners make this mistake and try to just stop all feeling, repress all feeling. I don't feel anything. Pretend they don't feel anything. Pretend they don't feel any attachment. Pretend they don't feel any aversion. You know, it doesn't work. It's not natural. It doesn't work. It can't be sustained. And it's we don't even like it. So that's not the process. Okay, so that, please cross that off our list. Repression, suppression, denial, you know, vegetative state, rock-like state. So how are we going to do it? So there's different techniques used in different types of yoga. There's basically four types of yoga. There's karma yoga, the yoga of action. There's gyan yoga, the yoga of knowledge. There's dhyan yoga, the yoga of mechanical meditation. And bhakti yoga, the yoga of loving connection. So it's all of these are explained in different parts of the Bhagavad Gita, and to some extent here in the second chapter, which is a summary of the Bhagavad Gita. And bhakti yoga actually includes the aspects of the other three yogas. So in bhakti yoga, there is detached action. In bhakti yoga, there is detachment through philosophy. And in bhakti yoga, there is detachment through meditation. Those are all included in bhakti yoga. But the essence of detachment in bhakti yoga is different, which we've already kind of hinted at how that works. So in karma yoga, as Krishna very nicely explains elsewhere in the Bhagavad Gita, that by giving up the results of one's work, one develops this peacefulness and this equanimity. I particularly like the explanation in the 12th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, which is about bhakti yoga, but the explanation is also, of course, given in the 3rd and the 5th chapter, which are dedicated to karma yoga, and to some extent in the 4th chapter, which is how to do karma yoga in transcendental knowledge. So in the system of karma yoga, you work hard for something, but you don't enjoy what you've worked for. What you've worked for, you give to the Lord for enjoyment. And ideally in karma yoga, you don't even try to, even at the while you're in the process of doing the work, you're surrendering that enjoyment of the work. You're doing detached work. So when one is taking what one normally does for pleasure, for sensory and mental pleasure, and one is doing it for liberation. I'm doing this work as a duty, not as an imposition kind of duty, not as an obligation. I'm doing this work because it's what I'm supposed to do. It's the right thing to do. It's what's in harmony with the universe. It's what's in harmony with the Lord. I'm doing it just because this is what I'm meant to do. This is what I'm designed to do. A lot of fiction is like that. You know, the hero, I'm doing this because it's the right thing to do. It's what I'm meant to be doing. It's what I'm born to be doing. It's what I'm designed to do. I'm doing my role in the universe. And I'm not doing it for my pleasure. I'm doing it for the good of the kingdom, for the good of the citizens, and ultimately for the good of God. And then one becomes detached because one is not trying to grasp the sensory and mental happiness that comes, and one is not trying to get rid of the sensory and mental distress that comes. One is taking one's happiness from the sense of giving, ultimately in karma yoga, from giving to the Lord. I'm getting my happiness from giving to the Lord. And as one does this, and this is sort of alluded to in this purport, the kshatriya who's fighting for the good of the country, who's fighting for the good of society, and therefore they're not affected by the difficulties or the pleasures of the fighting on a personal level. Or somebody who takes up sannyas at the end of life and they're doing it for the betterment of society, they're doing it for their spiritual betterment, so they're not affected by the good and bad of it, by the difficulty and the ease of it. And then there's gyan yoga. Gyan yoga is becoming more and more popular in the modern day. So there's more and more people taking to gyan yoga. Generally, they take to gyan yoga in the name of Buddhism. So there's a lot of Buddhist-inspired techniques that are becoming increasingly popular throughout the world as a form of being detached from happiness and distress with philosophy. So in gyan yoga, a person examines their thoughts and feelings and just basically tags them all as illusory. Oh, there's a thought. Oh, there's a feeling. Oh, there's a sensation. But I am the observer. And they learn how to use philosophy, a philosophical approach. Some of these are very, very popular. You know, a person will look at their thoughts and feelings and say, wait, is that absolutely true? Do I know it's true? If I believe it, what happens? I become involved in this world. I become affected. If I don't believe it, then I have freedom. Then I have detachment. And that sense of freedom is a much higher pleasure than becoming absorbed in this happiness and distress. So there's many, many forms of Gyan Yoga like that. And then there's Dhyan Yoga, so Dhyan Yoga, which is also becoming quite popular in the world and also, again, very much influenced by Buddhism, is to put one's mind in a state of calmness, where whatever thoughts and feelings and sensations pass by the mind, then one keeps the mind in a state of trance. And this is a mechanical process. I mean, there are many aids to meditation that are sold to modern people. Like, you know, you put some biofeedback device on your head and it measures your brain waves. And if you're in alpha waves or etc., then you know that you're in a different state. And it's quite interesting that Krishna's designed the human body to be able, through various sitting postures and various breathing and so forth, to be able to put the mind in a state where one does become detached from happiness and distress, and one goes to a higher state of freedom. And then in Bhakti Yoga, it's actually a more simple and natural way, which takes us to the root, and that is that we become happy in Krishna's happiness. Now, as I said, Bhakti Yoga includes doing detached work for Krishna, it includes being philosophical for Krishna, and it even includes meditating for Krishna. We meditate on the Maha Mantra, we meditate on the Gayatri Mantra, but it's done out of love. You know, even within this world, if I love somebody, even if I may love an animal, or I may love my country, or some ideology, so I can find happiness in serving that person or animal or ideology or group of some sort, such that my own happiness and distress separate from them become of no consequence to me. I don't even notice it. I become neutral towards it. You know, I become so happy by pleasing the person that I love, or again, it could be the animal or the country or whatever, that I don't notice personal happiness and distress. So while we can do this materially and it's not fully satisfying, if I do it for Krishna, if I become absorbed in Krishna's happiness, then it's very genuine. It's the reality of which this thing, when I do for other people or for my dog or for my country or my football team or whatever, is the shadow. When I do it for Krishna, it's the reality because I actually feel satisfied. Now again, doing that, it certainly involves these other techniques. So I work hard, but I work hard to please Krishna, whatever my work may be. So I'm writing a book with another devotee, Rukmini Devi Dasi from Columbus, and we're writing a book on career dharma, how to connect our career, our livelihood with the Supreme, how to use the knowledge of the Bhagavad Gita and the Srimad Bhagavatam such that we can have a satisfying means of livelihood. And one of the things that we look at is for various people to tell their stories of how they've taken their different jobs and use them for the service of the Lord. Then we also look at society as a whole. So just yesterday I was studying a little bit about what caused the big economic crash in 2007-2008, which was basically banks giving out bad loans to people for houses. So they would loan anybody money for a house, even if that person had no job and the person had no savings, you know. And then they would use these mortgages as something that people could invest in. So people could pay the banks money to invest in these mortgages. That the idea was when people paid off the mortgages, the people who were investing in them would also be making money. The banks were making money off the mortgages, and then the people investing in the banks and the mortgages were supposed to be making money off the mortgages, and then of course the banks are also making money off the investments. Then there were also people investing in those people that were investing in the mortgages, and there were people who were investing in the people who were investing in the mortgages, and so on and so forth. Out to many, 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 many levels. It's like if you were making a bet and then I was betting on your bet and somebody was betting on my bet, on your bet, and somebody was betting on your bet, on my bet, and so forth. But because the original thing was rotten, the original thing was fraudulent, the original thing was cheating, eventually the whole thing fell apart. And when the whole thing fell apart, so many people lost so much money. And of course, the main people who suffered were the little guys, the people who had bought these homes that the banks had convinced them they could buy, that they couldn't pay for, the people who had invested their savings in these rotten mortgages and who had lost all of their savings, and so many people who'd lost all their jobs, and so forth. And so I was thinking about a friend of mine, a devotee, where his job is to approve loans. That's his job. And he approves car loans, not house loans. But he was saying that the car dealership, they call him up and they say, please approve this loan. And the car dealership wants the bank to approve the loan because then the dealership gets all the money. And it's not there. They just collect all the money up front. It's the bank that then has the responsibility to collect if the person isn't qualified. Right? So this guy's job is to weed out unqualified car buyers. And I was thinking, you know, when you do that, if he actually does that job well and he actually weeds out unqualified car buyers, then he's maintaining a sense of fairness and equanimity and peace in society as a whole. You know, these guys who sold these mortgages improperly, they ended up destroying the whole economic fabric of the whole society in the world. And in all of our jobs are like that. All of our jobs that we have, you know, we might not think of them like that. We might think, well, I'm just trying to approve car loans for people to enjoy a car for their material purposes, for their maya, and so forth and so on, and this is all nonsense. But actually, it changes the whole fabric of society. And Krishna wants the fabric of society to be peaceful. That's what Krishna wants. Right? Krishna doesn't want that people in general are losing their money. He doesn't want the whole economy to collapse. He doesn't want people to be cheated. Because this is all part of his universal body. And so when a person does their work, whenever they're doing it, whatever work they may be doing, I mean, I'm not talking about something sinful. So if they're doing their work thinking, I'm doing this as part of the Lord's body. You know, what I'm talking about now is what we would call Vaishya work, which is nourishing the whole body. It's like the stomach of the universal form. I'm doing this for the Lord. I'm doing this to please the Lord. I'm doing this to keep the Lord, to serve the body of the Lord, to serve the part and parcels of the Lord, to make the Lord happy, that I'm doing my part within society. So the devotee can do whatever work they're doing, however seemingly mundane, however seemingly trivial. It's not really like that. Everyone's action affects thousands and thousands of people in society. And one is doing that not to enjoy it. Oh, you know, I'm making so much money at work, or I'm facilitating this, and not to hate it. Oh, I'm just facilitating people buying a car. But to see it like that as a service. And then in terms of jnana, that one sees where Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, right? Prakrite kriyamanani gunai karmani sarvasha ahankaravimudhatma kartaham iti manyate. It's really just the modes of nature acting and changing. It's not really me. I'm not the doer. I, the soul, am not experiencing this happiness and distress. How interesting Krishna's energy is. How interesting Krishna's energy is. How interesting Krishna's energy is. To have that again. And again, to have that meditation. To be absorbed, as Krishna says in the 8th chapter, mam anusmam yujyacha. While we're doing our work, whatever it may be, to be absorbed in Krishna's name, in Krishna's form, in Krishna's qualities, and Krishna's pastimes, through a kind of even walking meditation. And that's not at all impossible. People go through their work meditating on their boyfriend or girlfriend or husband or wife or their dog or their upcoming vacation or something like that. And we can go through our life meditating on the Lord. So those are the processes for becoming detached from the sukha and dukkha of the world. Those are the processes that we should be doing, all of those. Now, it's very interesting that we do those processes as part of our sadhana bhakti. Doing our activities just to please Krishna, whether it's activities of dressing the deity or whether it's activities of approving car loans. We meditate on the philosophy that Krishna gives in the Bhagavad Gita and in the Bhagavatam. And by meditating on that philosophy, we get a mood of detachment. We realize we're the observer. We're in meditation on the Lord and His activities. And we're acting out of love for Him. In love for Him, it's easy to be absorbed in Him. Yeah? So that's part of our process for regaining our natural pure consciousness. And interestingly enough, it's also the effect of having that pure consciousness. So a person who is in Krishna consciousness, a person who is conscious of Krishna, a person who's conscious of themselves as a soul, naturally has no interest in material happiness and distress. It has no meaning for them. It just doesn't mean anything. Again, it's a practical matter that you want to eat food and you don't want to eat, you know, plastic. That you don't want a snake to bite your body. But it doesn't really mean anything. It's a formality. It's some superficial, practical thing. So it's both part of the process of bhakti and it's an effect of bhakti. And this should be clearly understood because many times people will say, well, I can't do that because I'm not a pure devotee yet. First I'm going to become a pure devotee and then I'll be detached from happiness and distress. No, becoming detached from material happiness and distress is part of the sadhana. Therefore we have amritavaya kalpate. Amrita. So mritya means death. Amrita means freedom from death or liberation. Kalpate is considered eligible. So this is not just a symptom of one who's already liberated, but it's also part of the eligibility for liberation. So practicing this through our actions, through our mentality, through our meditation, and through our love and attachment for Krishna, practicing this gives us, it's one of the items of what we call the adhikar, or the right, the qualification. You know, like sometimes you may see a door, authorized persons only. You know, you have to have some kind of eligibility to go in that door. Some kind of adhikar in order to enter into that door, in order to do that thing. In every tradition, there are certain sacred writings that are only available to certain people. Only certain people have the adhikar. Or a certain mantra, certain rituals that are only available to certain people. Like in our Hare Krishna movement, we have certain kinds of worship. They're only available to people who are chanting the Gayatri mantras and who receive those Gayatri mantras in Diksha from a bona fide guru. So we have certain levels of qualification. Yeah? So having this detachment from the material happiness and distress is a kind of qualification. It's not the only qualification for liberation. So we want to practice that. It's not that just, well, you know, I'm going to be attached to material happiness and distress while I'm so-called in Krishna consciousness as if it's just some sort of religion that I'm in. And one day I'm just going to wake up and I'll be detached from happiness and distress. So it is true that achieving full Krishna consciousness makes one immediately detached from all happiness and distress. But at the same time, it's part of the process of becoming eligible, if that's clear. We could make a comparison to, you know, you bring roses to someone that you love. So, you know, you bring roses to somebody, that builds the love. It creates the love. You know, you might bring roses to someone on a first date. You don't really have a relationship. It's part of building the relationship. And you might bring roses to someone you've been married to for 50 years as an expression of the love that's already there. So if I already love you, I'm going to give you flowers. And to grow my love for you, I'm going to give you flowers. Right? Or to give you food. You know, I'll cook you a nice meal as a way of developing a relationship with you. And I'll cook you a nice meal as a way of expressing the love that's already there. So this being detached and equipoised toward material happiness and distress is both an expression of existing love for Krishna and a means to be eligible to entering into love for Krishna. Now, why is it a means of eligibility? And as we said in the beginning, that in order to accept spiritual happiness and reject spiritual distress, the things that pull us away from Krishna, the things that pull us away from Krishna are being attached to material happiness and distress. It's just like in any relationship, I want to do the things that nurture the relationship, and I want to avoid the things that harm the relationship. So what harms my relationship with Krishna is trying to take my happiness and avoiding my distress on an illusory platform. I mean, going back to the beginning, we made this point in the beginning, but just to reiterate it, and talking about this happiness and distress, as we talked about in the beginning, as part of illusion. It's like the happiness and distress a person feels from some, you know, intoxicant addiction. Again, in an ordinary relationship, we all know that if someone's addicted to an intoxicant, it hampers that relationship with the other person. You know, how many relationships of, you know, marriage or parent and children or whatever, brother and sister, friends and friends, employers, employees, how many relationships have been damaged or destroyed by somebody being an alcoholic or somebody being a drug addict? The person's attachment to the happiness and distress of an illusion hurts or destroys the happiness and distress of the real relationship. They're not able to participate in the real relationship because they're trying to participate in the illusion. So both the happiness of sensual and mental things and the pain of sensual and mental things, both of those as a package together, are unfavorable for spiritual life. They pull us away from spiritual life. So becoming neutral toward them, not being adverse to them, we have the word sama and dira, not hating them, not repressing them. Krishna is not advising repression. Helps to make us eligible to experience the real happiness of spirituality. You know, it's not just that we're rejecting illicit sex, intoxication, meat eating, and gambling. What we're rejecting is trying to enjoy and trying to avoid suffering in the material world, thinking that that's me, that's my source of existence. Now, also, it makes us eligible for liberation in that it puts our mind in a state of receptivity for spirituality. Because when the mind is detached from material happiness and material distress, again, I want to reiterate, it still means that we would eat healthy food and that we would avoid getting bitten by snakes. But when our mind is in a state of equanimity, when we're not like, you know, I have to have that pizza, and oh my God, I have to destroy this person who's bothering me, the mind becomes peaceful. And Krishna explains nicely a little later on in the second chapter that we can't have happiness without peace. We can't have happiness without peace. And peace comes from this equanimity. You know, that's where it comes from. Peace doesn't come from our external situation. Come on, we all know this. We can all be in a wonderful, peaceful situation. Like right now, I'm in a really peaceful situation, okay? I have this really nice room. It's good weather outside. My health is good. Nobody's criticizing me, at least not to my face that I'm aware of. You know, I don't have, and not in some kind of severe financial difficulty. I just don't have any of those things. We got the orange man out of the White House. I mean, things are kind of peaceful, you know? But I could still be in anxiety, right? How many things could I be in anxiety about? I could be in anxiety that somebody said something to me 10 years ago or did something to me 10 years ago and I'm still replaying that in my mind, right? Do we ever do that? Everything externally is cool and I'm just playing something in my mind. I could be in anxiety about the future. I could think, oh, I have this to do tomorrow and that tomorrow. What about this thing? What about that thing? And this person likes me now, but they may hate me in the future. And, you know, I may lose all my money tomorrow and I may do that. Right? I can create all these anxieties for myself. Yes? So when the mind is peaceful, when the mind is detached, then the mind is peaceful. The mind is not going to be peaceful just by arranging our circumstance. It doesn't work. Like right now, everything in my circumstance is nice, but, you know, it's not going to be in the future. There'll be something. It definitely will happen. You know, how long does everything just stay just nice? And if I'm dependent on my circumstances for my feeling of equanimity, then I'm always going to be in anxiety about arranging my circumstances. So the mind has to be appeased from within by this not caring about happiness and distress. And as soon as the mind is peaceful, as soon as this mind in this sama state, right? Krishna explains also in the Bhagavad Gita that for one who's conquered the mind, the super soul has already reached where he has attained tranquility. One becomes receptive to the presence of God. God's already there. Krishna's already there. He's already there. He's already in my heart. He's already in my breathing. He's already in my digestion. He's already in the light. He's already in the sounds. The refrigerator I have here is always making sounds. It always sounds like it has some sort of indigestion. And Krishna says, I'm the sounds. I'm the sounds and ether. That's him. It's already there. But when my mind is in a state of equanimity, I become aware. When my mind's trying to grasp sensory and mental happiness, and my mind's trying to push away sensory and mental distress, then I'm not able to grasp the fact that Krishna is around me. I'm not able to grasp the fact of my own identity. So I become receptive. It also indicates to Krishna my sincerity. You know, my attachment to illusory happiness and my aversion to material distress, illusory distress, is symptomatic of my attachment to want to be the lord of the world. I want to control the world and I want to make everything in the world situated so that I'm always happy and I'm never in distress. And I'm going to get it down, you know. I'm going to make enough money and have the right place and have the right friends and get rid of the right enemies and, you know, buy the right things and get the right status. And I'm going to, Ishwaraham Mahambhogi Siddham, I'm going to set everything up. Right? That's the antithesis of my relationship with Krishna. Right? Jivarasura Paya Krishna Nityadasa. I am your servant. You are the controller. Sarvaloka Maheshwaram, you are the controller of everything. So when I even try for this equanimity, even if I fail at it. And remember, because it's part of the process, I'm not going to be getting it right all the time as I'm working on it. You know, like if I'm practicing the piano, I'm going to keep messing it up. So if I'm practicing this equanimity, I'm going to keep messing it up. Sometimes I'm going to get attached to this material happiness, and sometimes I'm going to be averse to the material distress because I've been doing it for billions and billions of lifetimes. But just the fact that I'm making an effort to do that, Krishna sees, oh, you're trying to reestablish your relationship with me. You're making an effort. You're reaching out to me. Right? You're reaching out to me. Just like sometimes we get estranged from someone in our human relationship. And maybe it's someone who really wants a relationship with us. And when we reach out and say, hey, you know, I'd like to revive this relationship. Then they start to reach out to us. And Prabhupada says, we take one step towards Krishna, he will take 10 steps towards us. So this shows Krishna that we're sincere. So in all these ways, it makes us eligible for liberation. And once we achieve liberation, then we also achieve total equanimity towards happiness and distress. Now Krishna's bringing this up because it's one of Arjuna's main concerns. He's very concerned about sin. He's very concerned about ruining society, ruining the family. He's very concerned about enjoying the kingdom. He's worried that he won't enjoy the kingdom if he kills all his relatives. So he's really worried about all this happiness and distress. and he's worried about how am I going to be able to fight this battle in a way that doesn't have all these ill effects. I don't see how I can do it, he's saying. That if I fight this battle, all these terrible things will happen. It will just be awful. And so there's no way I can fight. But, you know, not fighting isn't a very good option either. What's he going to do if he doesn't fight? He said, better to live by begging, you know. But he's not thinking about his brothers and his wife and so many things when he's saying that I'm just going to walk away. So this is something that we should practice. We have to understand what it means to be equal in happiness and distress, and it's something that we should be practicing as part of our bhakti. Even if we're not very good at it, even if we keep failing at it, still we should keep making an effort to practice it. And to practice it not with repression, but with detachment, and by going for a higher taste, by going for the higher happiness of spirituality, which automatically makes us lose our interest in the illusory happiness and distress. So we have quite a bit of time open for questions and comments, and I think you also have this class on another platform besides Zoom. So there may be questions coming from there. And
are there questions coming from there?
Do we have
We are broadcasting on Facebook, but we don't have any questions raised.
All right, well, we can have any discussion here if people want to write in a chat or if they want to unmute themselves or whatever.
And Sasha, please keep your eye on Facebook in case there's a question. So as Irma Lamachi said, if someone has a question, you can unmute yourself. This is a great time.
If nobody has any questions, then you can just have a long kirtan.
Hare Krishna, Pramila, Prabhu.
Hare Krishna.
I have a quick question in terms of equanimity with those of us that are like married and we have relationships with others. Like, how does that factor in when we're relating to others with what you said of not trying to become cold-hearted or hard-hearted? Like, how do we reach that balance when we're interacting with others and wanting to make sure that they know that we love them and that we're in a loving relationship, but not falling into, you know, that kind of duality that you were describing? Not sure if I'm asking the correct question.
Well, I think I understand you correctly. I'll try to answer, and if my answer doesn't answer it, then you can explain it to me further. How's that? So I was giving the example of the person who's approving car loans. So the person approving car loans can do it because he's concerned about the individuals who want to buy a car, and he can do it because he's concerned about the car dealership, and he can do it because he's concerned about the bank, and he can do it because he's concerned about getting his paycheck, and because he's concerned about his status at the bank, and he's worried about what different people will think of him and how different people will enjoy and how he'll enjoy or how he'll suffer. Or he can do it thinking about how Krishna will be happy with his work. Now, if he thinks how Krishna will be happy with his work, he's going to then automatically have a spiritual love and concern for all the people that he deals with. If he's thinking, well, you know, like let's say he has to disapprove a loan because the people aren't qualified to get it. Right, so they might not be very happy with him initially because they're going to think, well, you know, I can't get the car I like. But he's seeing that by not allowing them to get the car that they like, he's keeping the balance in the economy for the whole world. And he's ultimately benefiting these people from being in a situation where they're going to default on their loan, they won't be able to pay it, they'll be in some kind of difficulty. And that will very much, all these things will very much please Krishna, who wants people taken care of, who wants people protected, who wants there to be stability and prosperity in society so that everybody has a firm foundation for advancement. And when I'm thinking, what would make Krishna happy? What would make Krishna happy? Then I'm going to genuinely care about everyone. I'm going to genuinely care about the car dealership, because if they keep selling cars to people who can't afford them, they're going to get a bad reputation. People will say, yeah, you know, I bought a car from that place. They convinced me to get something that I really couldn't afford. And then, you know, my whole life went down the tubes. They didn't really care about me as a person. They didn't really think about me holistically. Right? So that's real love for everyone, whether it's our husband, our wife, our children, our customers, our employees, our employers. As soon as we're thinking, let me give Krishna happiness by my action, and let me experience the happiness of spirituality by my action, then everything else is included. And as soon as we try to do it separately, it doesn't really work. You know, I give the example all the time. If you try to satisfy your husband just separately, so maybe your husband really likes lasagna, you know, so you make lasagna on Monday, and he's like, oh, wow, you've made lasagna. I love this lasagna. Then you make it again on Tuesday. And he says, well, 2 days in a row? Why are you making it 2 days in a row? You know, this is the problem with trying to please people independently of Krishna. It just, you know, what pleases somebody on Monday displeases them on Tuesday. What pleases them at 10 o'clock in the morning displeases them at 11 o'clock. We cannot consistently please another jiva independently of Krishna. It just doesn't work. And then our reasons for pleasing the other jiva become tied to our illusion. I am a wife. I am a good wife. No, I'm a soul. And then I become dependent on how my husband and my children and my parents and my in-laws and everybody else in the community and myself all perceive, am I a good wife? 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 And sometimes I'll think I'm a good wife, and sometimes I'll think, oh, I really wasn't a very good wife. And sometimes my husband will think I'm a good wife, and sometimes I'll think I'm not a very good wife. Sometimes my children will think I'm, and on and on and on and on and on. And so then my whole sense of identity, my whole sense of being is wrapped up in this false thing. And so that's why, it's one of the big reasons why we get angry at people. You know, I worked so hard for you to make lasagna 2 days in a row and you don't appreciate it, you don't appreciate me. And it's all part of this false identity. But if I'm trying to please Krishna, if I'm trying to act as a soul, then it's completely different. Then whether people brand me as a good wife or a bad wife or a mediocre wife or whatever, it's not, my identity is not dependent on that. It's not what I'm identifying with. My sense of worth, my sense of existence. You know, then I always know I'm worthy of Krishna's love just because I'm a soul. I'm enough. Just because I'm a soul, just because I'm part of Krishna. And Krishna's pleased with my intention. Krishna's pleased with my effort. Krishna's not, he's not so much dependent on the result, which I can't control anyway. If I make an effort and an intention to give happiness to these other jivas that Krishna's put in my care, my husband, my children, my parents, my in-laws, my whatever, my siblings, my boss, so Krishna will be happy, then I'm going to feel satisfied whether those other people are happy with me or not, as they're changing, flowing happiness and distress. I'm not dependent on that. So I'm going to love them much better. You know, materially, I'm going to love people very much dependent on their reciprocating with me. So I'm going to love them if they appreciate me, if they're grateful for me, if they, you know, shore up this false identity, then I'm going to love them. But I can love them as souls whether they do that or not. It's just not dependent on that. So when we met Prabhupada in 1976, so our oldest son, who was about a year and a half, was sitting on my lap. And Srila Prabhupada used me as an example, and he said, just like, he was talking to my father, and he said, just like she's loving her child without expectation of return, in the same way one should love Krishna. And my father said, will loving her child help her to love Krishna? And Prabhupada said, no. Loving Krishna will help her to love her child. So, like that. Did I answer the actual question you were asking? Or did I miss
it? You answered it and even expanded on it further to bring so much clarity to me. Thank you so much, Amila.
Oh,
I really appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Okay, good.
I'm here, Radha. I just wanted to touch on that equality thing. Can I touch? Just 2 minutes.
Okay.
Just sharing my opinion. So now, I just want to give an example just to understand the pleasure and the pain, how the mind interprets it. So let's say there's a person, he's jogging, and he's good, he does like 1 mile and half an hour, the next day, 2 miles, 3 miles, happy, happy, happy. And all of a sudden he meets a friend who is like, oh, he's a marathon guy, and he's like, I can do 30 miles in half an hour, nothing to me. You know, my God, I'm nothing. So this guy says, oh my God, nothing, I feel so painful, oh, nothing, I did nothing. So same state, it made the mind happy, and it made the mind painful.
Yes.
So what really is happening is a comparison operator between two events. One event where, let us say, he was like putting, one event is different from other event, and the delta, in the first case, 1 mile, second mile, third mile, fifth mile, the delta is positive in his experience, so he's happy. And the same event is combined with other event, he's taking 30 miles half an hour. It's different, the delta is different. So mind decides in the two events, it is happy or it's painful, is that comparison operator. Let us say that I'm to all events separately. I take off a memory portion, okay, memory helps in comparison operator. Then all the events are isolated. The mind cannot tell, is it happy or is it actually painful? I'm just sharing a view on this.
Very nice. So now what you just did, would you call that karma yoga, gyan yoga, dhyan yoga, or bhakti yoga?
So in karma yoga, you say that the fruit is isolated.
Now, how you described, what kind of yoga is that? What you just said? What were you just doing?
Okay, so now because the mind is doing some work, so it has to fall in the, but not in the condition of the karma yoga, but because it's doing some work.
No, I'm asking what you were doing. No, what you personally, in the last 3 minutes, with this explanation, what kind of yoga were you doing just then?
I was doing karma yoga?
No.
Why?
No, you weren't doing karma yoga. What kind of yoga were you doing?
Okay, I don't know what I was doing.
So you were doing gyan yoga. So what you just did was gyan yoga. You were analyzing a situation of a person running and being happy with himself, and then, practically speaking, the identical situation, but because there's some comparison, all of a sudden they're not happy with themselves. So therefore, analyzing that it wasn't the running that was making them happy or unhappy, it was the mind. Am I correct?
Yeah, because the entire thing of pleasure and pain happens in the mind.
In the mind. So that analysis that you just did is gyan. That is gyan. And using that kind of analysis to become detached from happiness and distress is gyan yoga.
What I understand why this is gyan yoga, and then what set of conditions and what principles would be termed this as gyan yoga, just to understand.
Because you're using philosophy and analysis to achieve detachment.
Okay,
got that? Now, you can do that as part of bhakti. You could do that separately from bhakti. You could do it as a separate yoga from bhakti, which many people do. Or you could do it as part of bhakti. So how do you do that as part of bhakti? You see, oh, the mind is Krishna's energy. These circumstances are Krishna's energy. And you have some appreciation and some gratitude for the wonderful workings of Krishna's energy.
Just one point on this, as you said, on the Gyan Yoga, sorry to interrupt.
No problem.
So, like, as Brahman, like in Gyan Yoga, I realize that I am Brahman, okay? When I say I am Brahman, I am detaching myself, my identity, from the body, mind, and the thoughts. I am neither body, neither mind, and neither thought. None of them.
Yes.
And I also say that because I am not these three, we also say that I am not the doer, I am not the cutter. Why? Because the body, mind, and the thought, this compound, complex, works by the three modes of the nature, that is yoga mind.
Yes.
Now, because the karta is gone away, so you are detached from the food also. Okay, the food is also gone, and now you are Brahman, you are also detached from body, mind, all those three things. So now, because all these things are gone, the analysis thing is in mind. So that means you are already realized. So when you say, I am Brahman, I know that, that is Gyan Yoga. Now, that's pretty much tough, right? We can't do that. And that's why we go to other yogas.
Yes, but what you were doing just now in this analysis is also a process of achieving that through Gyan. So it's a process of achieving Brahman through Gyan.
So if I just complete the analogy, if I remove the comparison operator, right, that would be a patient in paralysis. What this, if I explain this in medical language, in medical terminology, what I remove in this whole analysis is, now if I remove memory, okay, and comparison operator, then the guy is very much alive, but there is no feedback, and that's a paralysis condition. How could you call a paralyzed medical patient as a yoga that he has realized Brahman?
Because somebody through Gyan achieves this detachment where they perceive the sensory input and they perceive the mental input, but they don't identify with it, and therefore they act on it for the preservation of the body, and in bhakti they would act on it for the devotional service, but they act on it without any personal attachment. Is that right?
Thank you.
And I thought you made a very nice contribution. That was very wonderful. Thank you.
Hare Krishna.
Yes.
Urmila, Machi, you mentioned how currently you're in you have circumstances which are sufficient peace. You said, including that the orange man is being removed from the White House.
Looks like it.
I remember we were just driving out of Manhattan a few minutes before it was announced, and then I saw videos of people dancing in the streets in various cities around the country, including in New York City, right after we pulled out. And anyways,
we should have been having a Hari Nam party out there.
I saw people also dancing in the streets to Kirtan. That was there as well in Manhattan. So I have to admit that this gave me a sense of happiness. So my question is, were it not the case that the orange man were to be removed from the White House, but he were to be reelected, if I were very Krishna conscious, how would I find happiness in that situation?
Well, I like that question because we have a lot of examples of this in the Shastra. So in the Shastra, we have very egotistical and narcissistic and cruel people who sometimes run governments. Right? We have Kamsa, we have Hiranyakashipu, we have Vena, we have all of them, and they far exceed whatever we've gone through in this country in the last 4 years. I mean, they'd be much more comparable to much heavier personalities that have been in other countries in the last few centuries. So, and people were still able to function in their Krishna consciousness even though Kamsa was in charge. You know, once the activities in Vrindavan are going on, the Rasa-lilas are going on, and so many things are going on, even though Kamsa's in charge. It's not that because Kamsa's in charge, nobody is engaging in Krishna consciousness. Now, it's true that, like, there were members of the Yadu dynasty that were hiding in caves, and, you know, Rohini had to be there without her husband for so many years, raising Balaram without Vasudev. So, you know, there's certainly, the devotees went through a lot of external difficulties, and the devotees always want there to be good government. I mean, I don't have any kind of illusions that we're going to have anybody running our government that would really be what I would consider to be a good government. I think that's kind of crazy. You know, they're all a bunch of rogues and thieves and cheaters. It's just that some of them are more gentlemanly about it. So it's... we all want a good government. We all want a righteous government. And if we could have really a righteous government, if we could have people, you know, if there were really God-conscious people who were running Wall Street, who were running Monsanto, who were running the governments, who were running the media, I mean, wow! That would be nice. And then we would rejoice because Krishna wants that. Krishna wants Yudhisthira's running the countries, you know. But even if Hiranyakashipu is running things, Krishna's still there. You know, we find Krishna in every circumstance. We don't want to be like the demigods when Nrisingadev killed Hiranyakashipu. And the demigods were praying. They said that as long as Hiranyakashipu was on the throne, our hearts were filled with thoughts of Hiranyakashipu. And now that you've killed him, we can think about you again. But we don't want to be in that mentality that, you know, that we're all we're thinking about is the political leader. Instead of thinking about Krishna, you know, we're thinking about some political leader, this one or that one, Tweedledum or Tweedledee, you know. I mean, that's not where we want to go. We don't want to be thinking of, you know, just absorbed in thoughts of the cheaters on Wall Street, or just absorbed in thoughts of, you know, the seed companies and how they're polluting the agriculture. You know, all these, there's demons everywhere. The people running the media, and how instead of having entertainment that enlightens people, they're having entertainment that degrades. I mean, we just look across the board. You know, in every area of life, in modern society, whether it's sports, whether it's sanitation, whether it's, you know, music and theater, whether it's construction, business, agriculture, medicine, like banking, pick anything. It's all being polluted. You know, examples of people that are doing things in a God-conscious way are few and far between. So we would like to have a society where the leaders in all areas of life were God-conscious people. And Prabhupada said that doesn't mean you have to be members of ISKCON. Mathematics is mathematics. So this is what we would really like. And yeah, we should be able to remember Krishna in all circumstances. Whether, you know, if we're in the Soviet Union under Stalin, if we were in Nazi Germany under Hitler, and if we were, you know, in Yudhisthira's time under Yudhisthira. We want to be able to remember Krishna in all circumstances. You know, at the same time, I mean, we have some gratitude that at least people can externally act like ladies and gentlemen. That's something. We'd rather our leaders at least have a show of being ladies and gentlemen. That's something. And we'd rather that our leaders, you know, aren't destroying the planet. Line their own pockets. I mean, yeah, that's something. But we're not going to get, you know, we're not going to have an altogether favorable situation until we get people who are conscious of God into positions of leadership in all areas, or unless we help the people who are already in positions of leadership become genuinely God-conscious persons. You know, those two things are things that we need to do. So I think time is up. And I hope you will excuse me that I need to go. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Thank you so much for coming.
Facilitating.
Would everyone please join me in expressing appreciation for Arulachi. Hari Bol!
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 Hari Bol! Thank you!
Hari Bol!